Thomas Edison. "I didn't beat Edison," continued Bell. "The silly fool beat himself. I was just clever enough to let him do it."
"What do you mean?"
"The most dangerous enemy that Thomas Edison will ever face is Thomas Edison. And even after all this time, he still hasn't learned his lesson."
"You're being terribly cryptic.
Have you ever picked up one of those papers? The Wall Street Journal?"
"Yes," answered Paul.
"Rubbish things. But a friend was here last week, brought a stack along. All the information you need to know to beat Edison is in one of those."
"Edison's stock price? It's at an all-time high. I don't understand how that helps us."
"Edison's stock is valued highly," said Agnes, "because everyone believes that he's going to defeat Westinghouse."
"Go on," said Bell.
"And that is the primary source of its value," suggested Agnes.
Bell smiled.
"Honestly," he said to Paul, "your fiancé has a much better head for business than you do."
Paul did his best to ignore this comment.
"You're suggesting that we spread rumors to depress the value of his stock?"
"You've no need to lie. The truth is damning enough."
"And the truth is?"
"All right," said Bell. "You asked how I beat him. It was exceptionally simple. I invented the damn thing before he did. I was quick, he was late. That's the thing that kills him even to this day. It wasn't that I was a better inventor than he was. It was that he was so obsessed with solving a different problem that he didn't even notice the answer to the telephone problem was lying right at his feet. He was consumed with telegraphs. He'd been working on them for a decade even then. He'd done some early work on the telephone but felt it was a distraction. Why would he waste time on some silly talking box when his telegraph lines were getting finer and finer? He actually had the idea for the phone at the same time as I did, you know. It's not a secret. And this is what will haunt that poor man until his dying day. He had the idea at the same time, but I patented it. And the law is the law. Do you know, I think that's why he's been so rough with Westinghouse. He must have vowed never to make such a mistake again. I already showed that he lied on his patent application for the incandescent lamp," said Paul. "It did no good."
"No," said Agnes. "That's not the point that Mr. Bell is trying to make."
"Correct," said Bell.
"He's saying," said Agnes, "that Edison is an obsessive, like someone else I know. And this is Edison's weakness. He becomes so fixated on one line of attack that he becomes completely oblivious to another one."
"Clever girl," said Bell.
"A reverse salient?" asked Agnes. Bell laughed approvingly.
"What?"
Paul was confused.
"Sometimes an army will intentionally create a reverse salient in its forward line," she said. "A point of such obvious weakness that its enemy cannot help but take advantage. Do you know much about military history?"
"How do you know much about military history?" asked Paul.
"I was once friendly with a general in London. Anyhow, what is the obvious weakness of Westinghouse's? What is his reverse salient that has so consumed Edison?"
Paul struggled not to let his thoughts stray to this general in Agnes's past.
"I would think," said Bell, "that Mr. Cravath would know the singular obsession of Thomas Edison better than just about anyone else in the world."
"The lawsuit!" exclaimed Agnes. "Paul, you've been saying for months that this lawsuit is costing Westinghouse a fortune."
"Yes."
"Do you think it's costing Edison any less?"
As Paul finally understood the point that Bell and Agnes had been making, he began to smile. "Edison is so focused on winning the patent war," he said, "that he's forgotten that he also needs to win the corporate war. The Edison General Electric Company, it's not actually profitable. He's running the thing into the red to beat Westinghouse, undercutting his prices so severely that he's barely eking out a profit, throwing a fortune away on legal fees, a fortune that I cannot imagine that his attorneys have so graciously deferred."
"You're deferring your legal fees," said Bell. "Remind me to hire you the next time Edison sues me."
"Sooner or later, Edison's shareholders will notice their lack of profit,"
said Paul, and they will not be pleased.
The question you need to ask yourself, said Bell, is, who is the largest shareholder in EGE, besides Edison himself?
Paul and Agnes both knew the answer.
60%, she said very quietly. It's hard to get much larger than that.
Paul remained silent as he put the pieces together.
I get the impression that a plan is forming, suggested Bell.
The old man couldn't help but tease his youthful guests. Paul stood suddenly.
I know how we're going to win, he said. You look amused, she said.
Well, it is rather funny, he replied. It turns out that, quite fortuitously, you might be the only person in the whole world who can help me do it.
Part 3. Solutions. Contrary to popular myth, technology does not result from a series of searches for the one best solution to a problem. Instead, practitioners of technology confront insolvable issues, make mistakes, and cause controversies and failures. They create new problems as they solve old ones. Thomas Hughes, American Genesis. Chapter 58. The Metropolitan Opera House Ball. You can't connect the dots looking forward, you can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. This approach has never let me down, and it has made all the difference in my life. Steve Jobs. It could be fairly said that the New Year's ball at the Metropolitan Opera House was the second most exclusive party in the world. Credit would need to be given to the first, Mrs. Jacob Astor's summer gala. That preeminent party was limited to 400 guests who crammed into the Astor's Newport estate for one sweaty, well-sauced evening each July. Mrs. Astor composed the list of attendees herself and, in a colorful flourish, would stamp by hand each invitation as it went out. New York society would spend their Junes nervously checking their mail tables for the telltale stamp upon the incoming envelopes. The names and qualifications of the guests were duly reported in the Times and the World. Harper's typically documented the event with a page-wide pencil sketch of city glamour at its most impossibly dense. New Year's at the Met was more than twice as populous, which made the party necessarily half as glamorous. The guest list topped 1,000 and included more than the usual stock of stiff gentry. Also invited were crude politicians, European dancers in for the season, and young women of such beauty that one would never know they possessed only a simple West Side mansion and a generous uncle along Union Square. For one night, artists and railroad tycoons and English dukes all mingled effervescently. The notables of New York bounced against one another like the fizzy bubbles in the champagne flutes. Not coincidentally, Mrs. Astor was also a principal organizer of this second-place gala. This was due less to her personal investment in the Met and more to her simple dictate that no party of any great significance should take place in Manhattan without her involvement. Her monopoly on the New York social scene was more thorough than her husband's was on American coal. But while the Met's yearly party lagged behind Mrs. Astor's ball in exclusivity, it more than made up for this shortcoming by the ingenuity of its fashions. Whereas the July party stood as a symbol of black-on-white formality, New Year's was a rainbow atop a bright pile of gold. The men were, of course, white-tied and black-tailed in the appropriate manner, but the women were permitted, encouraged, to show what could be done with a yard of silk and a carefully stitched bit of muslin. Diamonds were hung across every limb a woman could bear. Paul knew all of this merely from newspapers and magazines. He was left to imagine the scene inside the party, however, as he stood shivering in the alley behind 39th Street at 10:45 in the evening. There was little more than an hour left of 1889.
He could hear the party from the street. Paul was very cold. He'd been waiting in the alley for almost an hour, during which time Agnes was the only thing standing between himself and hypothermia. She was also the only thing standing between the Westinghouse Electric Company and bankruptcy. Paul needed to get into that party. He would wait for her as long as it took, whether or not his toes blackened from frost. With a sudden screech, the metal door swung open and Agnes appeared in the orange light. She effortlessly wore a dress of shocking yellow, elegant and tasteful, yet more delicately stitched than it might at first appear.
"Lord, it's freezing out here," she said. "Hurry up and get in."
She yanked the door shut behind them and led Paul through the winding maze of corridors. He hadn't been back to the Met in a year since Tesla's arrival in Agnes's dressing room. He still hadn't ever been to a performance.
"Is he here?"
asked Paul when it no longer pained him to move his lips.
"Yes," replied Agnes. "But there's a problem. He has a friend with him."
"Who?"
"Thomas Edison."
Paul stopped.
"Damn it."
"I know. Was Edison on the guest list?"
"Who knows? If I had been able to get a copy, I'd have a shot at getting your name on it. Clearly, we've had to make do with other means. My guess is that Thomas Edison was permitted to use the front door."
This was going to make Paul's plan for the evening considerably more difficult.
"Are they together?" "Not every moment. Edison has a lot of admirers. He has rounds to make, handshakes, and tall tales. You'll have to find a minute when they're separated to make your move."
There was no chance of turning back. Paul followed Agnes toward the glittering ball in search of his target. All the seats had been removed from the auditorium, allowing the 1,000 guests to spread freely across the floor of the great domed room. Strings of electric lights hung from the balconies, stretching toward the stage in blinking spiderwebs. From the stage, a 40-person orchestra played a spirited waltz. The dancers swayed forward and back, the waves of motion splashing against the solid rocks of conversation that dotted the floor. Paul was a small trawler sailing into the rough seas of this crowd. Stepping slowly into the gala, he was practically knocked off his feet by a drunken couple who spun wildly through their dance.
"Careful," counseled Agnes. "We can't have you making a scene."
Paul watched Agnes glide across the floor. She was a bird in flight over the choppy ocean. But Agnes was no gull, he thought as she smiled, putting up bulwarks against the curious glances being cast in her direction. She was a hawk.
"Over there," said Paul, turning his head away.
Only 50 feet away was Thomas Edison, chatting amiably with acquaintances. He looked strangely younger in his tuxedo, the white bow tie askew below his chin. He was the only member of his circle without a drink in his hand.
"Do you know how to waltz?"
asked Agnes.
"What?"
She took his right hand with her left and held it at the level of her waist before grasping his left hand with her right. Then she spun. It took Paul a few moments to realize that she was leading him onto the dance floor in a 3-count twirl. He tried to remember the last time he'd danced a waltz. Her perfume washed over him, and for a moment, it was as if he were back with her at his parents' house on a warm Tennessee night.
"Steady," whispered Agnes. "Just follow me."
They spun across the dance floor, orbiting the other dancers. The room was a constellation of the very latest fashions. At first, he clomped against the glazed wood floor, but as she tugged at his hands, she gave shape to his movements.
"Slow," she whispered. "Quick, quick, slow. There it is, yes."
Paul struggled to fight the dizziness. She'd already told him that he needn't worry about the presence of Henry Jane, who was in Philadelphia with a sick relative. For an affianced couple, they spent little time together. Was that how it was done among the rich? He didn't think he could bear to be in the same room with the man. And he certainly didn't want to have such a meeting take place with his hand softly touching Agnes's hip. He felt her warm and even breath on his neck. He felt the muscles along her back tense and release with the rhythm of their dance. Paul knew that he wasn't only doing this for Westinghouse. He didn't need to win only to punish Edison. He needed Agnes to see that he was as worthy as Henry Jane.
"Edison is 30 feet behind you," she whispered, "while our man is 10 feet over there. Come on."
Agnes pressed at Paul's hands, urging him through the crush of partygoers. They approached a circle of 5 chattering men in perfect white collars and long black tails. None was under the age of 50, and all boasted the comfortable waistlines of lives well lived. At the center, Paul caught the eye of a large man, the only one of the lot without a beard. Instead, a thick brown mustache provided a striking contrast of color across his face. The hair parted across his head was a chalk white. His cheeks looked as if they had never once been forced into a smile. It was J.P. Morgan, the man he had come to see. Chapter 59. A Secret Meeting with the Richest Man in America. Capitalism has worked very well. Anyone who wants to move to North Korea is welcome. Bill Gates. The song came to a stop with a long and satisfying bow stroke from the violins. The guests clapped absent-mindedly, their graciousness as instinctive as a cough. Agnes was studying Morgan's circle.
"They look relatively drunk," she whispered conspiratorially. "Wait here."
She pulled free of Paul's grip. Before he could ask any questions, she had stepped away and dived into the middle of the group.
"Mr. Rutledge," she cooed to one of Morgan's associates, "how was Brussels?"
Paul watched as Agnes maneuvered herself into the men's conversation. They were rabbits to her fox. Paul heard their sudden laughter, saw their jockeying for position as each tried to impress the beautiful woman, shimmying gaily before them. Paul stood mutely to the side of their conversation, uninvited and straining to listen surreptitiously. In under a minute, Agnes had slipped her body into their circle in such a way that Morgan was cut off from the center. It was so subtle as to be not at all rude, and yet Morgan's isolation was unmistakable. Paul understood then what she was doing. If he had been impressed before, he was now doubly so. Morgan was not accustomed to being ignored. Paul began to sense boredom in the old man's stance. Morgan stepped back from the group with a glass of scotch in his hand. He walked across the dance floor, Paul following close behind. Morgan received a series of nods and smiles from the people he passed, but none seemed to interest him. He walked into the rear hallway and through the door of the gentleman's lounge. Paul waited 10 seconds before following him in. The lounge was long. Marble countertops lined one side, and a row of toilet stalls, likely stocked with the new chain pull design, lined the other. On the far wall, a chaise provided a comfortable perch for the weary. When Paul entered, Morgan was reclining onto the chaise, still clutching his glass. 2 other men stood by the mirrors. They fixed their loosened neckties as Morgan relaxed on the back chaise. He closed his eyes, as if enjoying this brief and singular moment of peace. Paul stood at the mirror, purposefully pulled his own tie out of place, and then feigned difficulty at writing it. He examined the part in his hair, making sure no strand had fallen astray. The 2 strangers seemed to feel that whatever conversation they'd been having before J.P. Morgan walked in would best be continued elsewhere. They exited, a back slap sealing their conspiracy. The door closed behind them. Paul had his chance. Paul quickly moved to the door and flipped the bolt. He had just locked himself into the men's lounge, alone with J.P. Morgan. Morgan heard the metal bolt snap into place and looked up at Paul.
It would be scant minutes before either Morgan's absence aroused unwanted interest outside, or the locked door attracted a passing servant's concern. Paul had very little time.
"If you're planning to rob me," said Morgan, still seated, "I should inform you that my pockets are empty." His utter nonchalance indicated that he was afraid of very little in this world. What private fears he might harbor certainly did not include strangers in white bow ties who made vaguely threatening advances at costume galas. The look of Paul, locked door or no, did not appear to concern Morgan in the slightest.
"My name is Paul Cravath."
"That's nice," said Morgan.
"I am a partner at Carter Hughes and Cravath."
"Your parents must be so proud."
"I am the lead attorney for George Westinghouse in his lawsuits against Thomas Edison."
"Oh, pity. Perhaps they're not so proud." Morgan stood. "Your name did sound familiar. I'm going to leave now."
He took a step toward the door. Paul stepped forward as well, making clear that he was putting his own body between Morgan and the exit.
"I have a proposition for you," said Paul.
"I have an office," said Morgan.
"It's confidential."
"Oh, my.
Thomas Edison is costing you money."
"You're costing me money. There's business to attend to out there."
Morgan stepped again in the direction of the door. Again, Paul made clear that he would not be moving aside.
"I used to keep a pistol on me, you know," said Morgan. "I am going to give my security boys quite an earful about convincing me not to carry it."
"The war between Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse is going to drive them both broke."
"And?"
"And as you own 60% of the stock in the Edison General Electric Company, I propose that this is an even bigger problem for you than it is for me."
"I might suggest that your biggest problem right now is what my friends are going to do to you when I get out of here."
"You and I have the same problem, and I propose that we work together to fix it."
Morgan didn't say a word. Edison and Westinghouse are dueling to the death over their respective slices of a pie that is only this big. Paul formed a small circle with his fingers. "But working together, we could take equal shares of a pie that is this big." Paul expanded his circle threefold.
"A partnership between the two companies, a licensing arrangement, would eliminate the burden for consumers of having to choose which of our incompatible products they wanted. AC, DC, it wouldn't matter. You could sell our current, we could sell your bulbs. Everyone wins. Let's stop putting the future of these companies in the hands of the courts. Let's stop leaving it to the vagaries of newspaper opinion and the shifting winds of the free market. Let's put the important decisions back in the boardroom, where they belong."
Morgan slipped his hands into his pockets. He pursed his lips.
"Competition," argued Paul, "does no one any good.
A friendly monopoly, on the other hand."
Morgan smiled. Paul was speaking in his native language.
"You've got some hustle in you."
"It takes one to know one."
"I'm not much of a hustler, Mr. Cravath. Whatever you've been told about me, I think the reality is far less dramatic than people like to say. You know who's a great hustler? Thomas. Or your friend Mr. Westinghouse. I'm just a simple businessman.
The most successful one in the world."
"It's the thing about businessmen. There is nothing of which we despair so much as a free market."
It was Paul's turn to smile.
"Off the top of my head," said Morgan, "I can think up a half dozen critical difficulties with this scheme. But the most clearly insurmountable is a simple one."
"What?"
"Thomas Edison."
He took a thoughtful sip of his scotch.
"I don't know what you've told Westinghouse, or even what you might, with that silvery tongue, be able to convince him of. But I can assure you that Thomas will never go along with this plan."
"I know," said Paul.
He despises Westinghouse.
I know.
So long as Thomas Edison is at the head of the Edison General Electric Company, it will engage in no partnership with your client. Paul moved a step closer to Morgan, placing his hand boldly on the industrial baron's left shoulder.
But whoever said Edison has to remain at the head of his company?
Chapter 60. Bury a penny. I just invent a thing, then wait until man comes around to needing what I've invented. Buckminster Fuller. Would you like to know the easiest way to make $1 billion? Asked J.P. Morgan the next day. They were standing among the Cypriot antique collection at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
I'd love to, replied Paul.
The two men gazed at the rows of ancient pottery before them. Take a penny, bury it in the ground for 1,000 years, then dig. Morgan gestured to the faded brown vases, intricately etched plates, and darkly stained pitchers that lined the walls of the hall. The Cypriot wing was vacant save for these relics. The voices of the two men echoed through the room. The museum was under construction. Scaffolding covered its Fifth Avenue facade.
Do you know Luigi di Cesnola? Morgan asked.
I'm afraid I don't, said Paul.
Sardinian. But he came here in the 50s. Fought in the war. Ours, not theirs. Well, theirs too, I think, at some point earlier. But he made his name in ours. After which, he sailed back to Cyprus, took care to amass this collection, and then sold it back here for... Well, Mr. Cravath, what do you think the museum board gave him for it?
I couldn't possibly say.
They gave him the museum. They made him the director. And the Metropolitan Museum of Art now has an antiquities collection that's starting to give London worry.
It sounds like a smart deal.
Bury a single penny, and in enough time you'll have yourself a fortune. That is my point. It only gets hard if you want to get it done a bit faster.
Paul looked around. They were still alone, and their secret meeting remained, so far as he could tell, unobserved.
You may speak freely here, Mr. Cravath. We have the wing to ourselves for the afternoon. Luigi is a good friend.
Paul knew that he should not be surprised by anything Morgan was capable of. Nothing in New York was beyond Morgan's grasp. Paul was certain that even as Morgan had entertained this talk of a partnership, the older man was in no sense his ally. He would turn against Paul in a second flat if it ever became in his financial interest to do so. One doesn't lie down with a lion and get to act surprised if one finds oneself devoured. Paul knew that there was a sizable chance that after their meeting at the ball, Morgan had rushed immediately to Edison with the sordid details of Paul's proposition. What mitigated his fears was the comforting reminder of Morgan's immense greed. While what motivated Tesla, Edison, and Westinghouse would always remain somewhat uncertain, what motivated Morgan was no mystery. No one amassed as much money as he had by accident. And it was unclear if anyone in the history of the world had ever before amassed that much money. Money was a far more predictable motivator than legacy, or fame, or love, or whatever else might rouse a man from his bedsheets. An artist, or an inventor, was a far more dangerous partner than a businessman. The latter's betrayals could be planned for, even depended upon.
You've examined my proposal, said Paul. You have the authority to stage a coup, so to speak, at EGE. You can depose Edison and put your own man in charge, someone sympathetic to our cause.
I know what I can do, Mr. Cravath. I have lawyers, too. They're quite a bit more experienced than you are.
And yet I'll wager they told you that everything I said was absolutely correct.
They did indeed.
And your accountants, I am sure, have analyzed the profits and losses of EGE as well. 2 cents, said Morgan. That is EGE's profit per share. It's not a loss, but it's not much in the way of benefit either.
So you see that I'm right. If you can depose Edison from inside, I can handle things on Westinghouse's end.
This seems terribly simple from your perspective, does it?
Yes, said Paul. It is mercilessly simple.
But that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Do you trust me? Paul was startled at the question.
Of course not, he replied honestly.
If he intended on negotiating toe-to-toe with the most powerful businessman of the age, then he would do so without insulting either of their intelligences by pretending that they were friends.
I don't trust you either, said Morgan, which is why I'm going to tell you a secret, a very expensive secret. And your response to this secret is going to give me quite a bit of information as to how far I need to go in distrusting you.
What is it?
This is going to be a bit more complicated than you think it is.
Why?
There's a spy inside the Westinghouse Electric Company.
Paul stared blankly. It could not be true. Westinghouse had chosen his team personally. His engineers, his factory foreman, even his lawyers.
Edison has a spy in Westinghouse's senior leadership. He's been reporting back all of Westinghouse's plans. Corporate strategy, the laboratory reports, even the designs of those Pennsylvania factories, to Edison. He's been doing it for more than a year. You idiots kept getting beat and you couldn't figure out why. Well, this is why.
Paul felt sick, but he could not show weakness.
How can you be sure Edison has a spy?
Because, replied Morgan, I was the one who put him there.
Paul looked Morgan dead in his calm, unblinking eyes. In confessing this secret, he seemed to feel neither pleasure nor relief.
Your plan is going to be significantly more complicated than you realize, Mr. Cravath, because if Westinghouse tells his senior staff about it, then our spy will tell Edison.
Who is it? Asked Paul. Who is the spy?
You bury a penny, said J.P. Morgan, his words echoing among the ancient pottery. And in 1,000 years you'll have a fortune. But if you want to get to the fortune a bit faster, you need to bury something a whole lot bigger than a penny.
Chapter 61. A Fox in the Chicken Coop. Is the sudden transformation of all the relevant scientific characters in your book from petty people to great and selfless men because they see together a beautiful corner of nature unveiled and forget themselves in the presence of the wonder? Or is it because our writer suddenly sees all his characters in a new and generous light because he has achieved success and confidence in his work and himself? Richard Feynman, from a letter to James Watson, concerning the latter's manuscript of his memoir, The Double Helix.
Reginald Fessenden.
Paul's mind raced to make sense of what Morgan had told him. Paul had not only spent hours by Fessenden's side over the past year, but had even recruited the man himself. It had been Paul's sales pitch that won Fessenden to their side after he'd been fired by Edison.
You're lying, said Paul. Frequently, but not as it happens today.
Prove it.
Morgan sighed.
You hired Fessenden yourself 18 months ago. You did so at a meeting at his Indiana office after coming to believe that Edison fired him. You read about the firing in the papers and went to find a bitter ex-Edison employee who might be bought off. You contacted Fessenden for information about Edison's patent filing, only... Well, tell me, Did he actually give you any information that would help you take down Edison's patent?
Paul replayed his first meeting with Fessenden in Indiana.
Of course he didn't, said Morgan. Your next question is going to be about why Fessenden sent you in the direction of, what's his name? Tesla. Because Edison thought it would be a waste of your time. Fessenden had to appear to be helpful while telling you something that wouldn't actually help at all. And so we figured we'd make use of that loony Serbian nut. Thomas got a copy of his Engineering Society lecture long before he delivered it, told me it was ridiculous. Which gave me the idea of sending you after him in the first place. That you managed to actually get some use out of that man, that was unexpected. It didn't make Thomas happy, I can tell you.
Paul felt suddenly naked. His thoughts and plans and seemingly clever moves over the past years now revealed to be but a pathetic sham. Edison had been outplaying them from the very start.
You believed you were hiring an apostate. What you were actually hiring was a Trojan horse. Fessenden took the job with your client specifically so that he could gain access to the latest Westinghouse technology. Bit of an irony, really, since Westinghouse thought he was getting access to Edison's.
But, Paul countered, Edison never made use of alternating current. If Fessenden has been leaking Westinghouse's designs, and you already had Tesla's lecture, Edison must have seen that it was superior to his own direct current work.
If what you're telling me is true, then how is it that Edison never created an AC device?
Ah, said Morgan. That's just the thing. Edison disagreed with your supposition. He saw the full reports. I did too, for that matter, not that I paid much mind to the technical gibberish. Edison thought he knew better. His advocacy of direct current, perhaps a mistaken one as it turns out, did not come from a place of subterfuge. He genuinely believed, after surveying all of his own research and all of yours as well, that his system was the better one.
He wasn't dishonest, but instead merely incompetent?
I would more charitably suggest that he simply followed the available evidence to a different conclusion. Scientists, you ask 100 of them a simple question, you get 100 different answers. They're a necessary annoyance in the industrial business, I suppose.
This was all your idea, said Paul. Fessenden, Tesla, the whole ruse.
Of course it was. Thomas isn't nearly devious enough to come up with something like this on his own.
This past autumn, when you were blocking our attempts to find new investors, this is how you knew who we were going to before we got there. This is how you were able to contact him first.
Morgan looked pleased.
I'd been wondering if you'd figured that out.
Paul had been in over his head from the moment he'd taken on the Westinghouse case. He'd been drowning in water even deeper than he'd known. Paul was clever. Tesla, Edison, and Westinghouse were geniuses. What was Morgan? Paul felt himself in the presence of something else entirely.
Is this the part where you pretend to be so much more noble than I am? Asked Morgan. I'd rather not bother, if it's all the same to you.
I didn't illegally place a spy in your company, Mr. Morgan.
Morgan spent a long moment looking Paul up and down.
Do you know what awaits you at the end of this, Mr. Cravath? I have a notion that you're going to gain all of the riches that you desire. Congratulations in advance. But have you considered what you might have to give up in return?
What's that?
The illusion that you ever deserved it.
Morgan gazed thoughtfully at a bronze statue. It depicted a warrior, spear in hand, galloping on horseback into a great and long-forgotten war.
Poor people all think they deserve to be rich, he continued. Rich people live every day with the uneasy knowledge that we do not. Morgan spoke as if they were the same class of men. As if Morgan were Paul's own reflection in a darkened mirror. Westinghouse is likely with Fessenden at this very moment, said Paul.
I'm sure.
I must speak with him. If he tells Fessenden about our plan... Paul prepared to run off to the nearest Western Union office before he had a better idea. Mr. Morgan, said Paul as he turned to face him, I'll ask you for one more favor.
Yes?
Could you find me a telephone? Chapter 62. Whether or not it's true. The good thing about science is that it's true, whether or not you believe in it. Neil deGrasse Tyson. As it happened, Luigi di Cesnola kept a telephone in his private office on the museum's third floor. As the device had been a gift from Morgan, Cesnola was more than happy to let the banker's young friend make use of it while he and Morgan smoked in the corridor outside. Paul listened nervously to the odd ringing noises emanating from the black earpiece he held up to his ear. A laboratory assistant finally picked up on the other end of the line. Paul demanded to speak urgently to George Westinghouse.
Paul? Came the scratchy but recognizable voice of George Westinghouse through the earpiece. It felt more like he was speaking with a ghost than with another human being.
There was Westinghouse's incorporeal voice right there, pressed against Paul's right ear. The personhood of Westinghouse had been reduced to a voice in the ether.
Are you completely alone? Said Paul. Did you meet with Morgan? Did he go for it?
Is anyone with you in the laboratory at the moment, next to you, while we're speaking? That assistant I just spoke with.
What are you talking about?
Please, are you alone?
Yes.
Paul could tell even this far away that Westinghouse was dismayed at the tenor of this conversation. But it couldn't be helped.
Then listen close.
Paul explained as plainly as he could what Morgan had told him. Westinghouse was shocked at first, and then incredulous. The lead engineer on all of his electrical projects had been working in secret for their enemy. Was Paul suggesting that he was some sort of fool?
I'll have the police here within the hour, said Westinghouse. His disbelief and embarrassment had given way to a righteous anger. False representation, intellectual theft, broken employment contracts, simple fraud, I will see him shackled before sundown.
That was my initial reaction as well, said Paul calmly into the receiver. Then I thought better of it.
Why?
Where is Fessenden now?
The lab, I should assume, gathering up every detail of my work on...
Can you keep him there? And keep him out of the meetings you'll need to have in the coming days concerning Edison?
Why would I do that? He should be arrested.
Think it through, sir. If you arrest Fessenden, what happens? There was silence on the line as Westinghouse went through the same series of thoughts that Paul had run through only a few minutes before.
Edison will know that we discovered his spy, said Westinghouse.
Yes.
He'll assume that one of his own people ratted him out.
Yes.
And then he'll go looking for a rotten apple inside his own barrel.
Which, said Paul, is exactly what we do not want him doing.
So what else would you propose?
Can you give Fessenden a task? Some sort of project. It can be a waste of time, I don't care what it is, to keep him busy.
I'm sure I can come up with something, said Westinghouse.
Do that. Meanwhile, we might be able to get some real use out of Fessenden yet.
How?
Anything we tell him will leak back to Edison.
Yes?
Whether or not it's true.
Westinghouse could not see the grin on Paul's face as these last words were spoken. And yet, as Paul listened patiently to the quiet clicks and hisses of the telephone wire, he hoped that far away, in an oak-lined office in the countryside near Pittsburgh, Westinghouse was grinning too. Chapter 63. Brief vignettes as the stage is set for the final performance. Before anything else, preparation is the key to success. Alexander Graham Bell. George Westinghouse listened carefully to Paul's plan before informing his attorney that he would not play a part in it. "You're asking me to tell the whole of my management team that you found Nikola Tesla?" asked Westinghouse incredulously. "Yes," said Paul. "Tell them Tesla has been hiding out in Chicago." "What? Why?" Westinghouse sputtered. "Why Chicago?"
"Because it's far away."
Paul could hear the huffing from the other end of the line. "Our aim is to distract Edison's attention, is it not?" continued Paul. "Very well. Edison knows that he's likely put you out of business unless you can come up with an original light bulb. Or unless Tesla can. So if we leak to Edison that Tesla has been working on just such a thing in secret from a laboratory in Chicago, he'll be distracted." Westinghouse did not answer. "It's the perfect wild goose chase," added Paul. "I will not lie to my entire staff. I'm sorry, but we can't have Fessenden growing suspicious. If you tell only him, he might catch on that something is afoot. The story needs to pervade the conversation of your employees."
"Edison will realize soon enough that Tesla is not in Chicago," said Westinghouse, "and that he has not designed any new light bulbs."
"Yes, but by then it won't matter." Paul heard a creak coming from the direction of the doorway. He turned to see J.P. Morgan framed in a wispy gray stream of cigar smoke. Having concluded his conversation with Luigi Di Cesnola, Morgan was ready for Paul to be finished as well. They had a lot of work in store for them, and J.P. Morgan did not look like a man who was accustomed to being kept waiting.
"No one will believe that Tesla has a secret laboratory in Chicago," came Westinghouse's voice through the telephone. "No one will even believe that he's still alive."
Paul had been dreading the conversation that he was about to have for a very long time. He felt lucky only that he did not have to see the look on his client's face as he confessed his deception. "Nikola Tesla is not in Chicago," said Paul. "But he is very much alive." As Paul kept talking, the pale smoke from Morgan's cigar drifted across the museum office. The next evening, Paul caught Agnes as she exited the rear door of the Metropolitan Opera House. Theatergoers poured from the Met onto 39th Street, the din of their commotion a background rattle. An hour to midnight, and Manhattan glowed with lights, both new and old.
"There you are!"
exclaimed Agnes. Her expression shifted from startled to worried.
"I went by your office looking for you."
"I've been busy. Is Morgan on board? Is it working?"
"I need you to go back to Tennessee," said Paul.
"Excuse me?"
"I'm sorry, we are in a terrible rush."
"A rush to do what?"
"I need you to collect Nikola and bring him here." Agnes gave Paul a long and searching look. They had been waiting for this moment for a very long time. Now that it had arrived, it came without fanfare or celebration. The hour felt grave. The night sky glittered.
"Why now?" she asked.
"Because I believe Thomas Edison is about to try to kill him."
"And you want me with Tesla when he does?"
"Of course not," said Paul.
"This time I want Edison to look for him in the wrong place."
Paul told her about his confession to his client and their move to make use of Fessenden's betrayal.
"I cannot imagine that your talk with Westinghouse was easy," she said.
"It wasn't."
"Are you all right?"
Paul had no idea how he felt anymore. He had only to press forward.
"He'll forgive you," she said.
But Paul was not of a mind to be comforted.
"Eventually,"
was all he said in response. "It doesn't matter now." There was no time, at the moment, for sentiment. Not even with Agnes.
"Where would you like me to take Tesla?"
she asked. Paul looked up at the bustle of Manhattan.
"Bring him home."
"Mr. Cravath," said Walter Carter as Paul walked into his office the next morning. "Where in the world have you been? We have a bankruptcy to attend to."
Paul had cabled his partners from Nashville, suggesting that there was one last resource he sought to exploit before declaring Westinghouse's bankruptcy. They had heard nothing from him since, save for admonitions to continue waiting.
"I need a favor," Paul said.
"We need to know what is happening. I wrote to Westinghouse, who said that he is aware of whatever it is you're up to. This is unconscionable, young man."
"I'm sorry, but this maneuver must remain a secret. Soon enough you'll know why. At the moment, Westinghouse and I need you to sue someone."
Carter looked at Paul for a long moment.
"What in the world are you talking about?"
"Fetch Hughes. There's a lawsuit we need you to bring, and we need you to do it right away. Do this, and you'll no longer need to attend to Westinghouse's bankruptcy. Instead, you may attend to his victory."
"Oh, yes?" said Carter. "And whom exactly would you like me to sue?"
"I actually don't care. Anyone. As long as his attorney is Lemuel Serrell."
Paul told him what he needed to know, and nothing more. By noon, Paul was waiting anxiously at the Western Union offices on the southern tip of Broadway. He focused his nervousness by pacing along the seams of the black and white marble blocks beneath his feet. Finally, the boy behind the counter tapped at the copper bars that shielded him from the general public. He gestured to Paul, who came near.
"We've a message for a Jonathan Springborn," said the boy.
"Thank you," said Paul as he took hold of the narrow slip of paper that the boy handed to him. The message was from Morgan. No first name or initials listed, and it was very short. "Received urgent message from T.E. Tesla alive. In Chicago. Full weight of EGE and Pinkertons sent to locate. Please advise." Paul's plan was working, so far.
"I'd like to wire a message back to this sender," said Paul to the boy, who dutifully took out his pen.
"Train to Chicago takes 36 hours, stop," said Paul. "Then 36 back, stop. We have 3 days to finish, stop."
"7 cents, said the boy after he quickly tallied up the words.
"It's worth a lot more than that," said Paul as he fished in his pocket for the coins. Later that afternoon, Paul took the Saugus line to Lynn, Massachusetts. It wasn't a long trip to the small town, nestled near the coast just 10 miles north of Boston. He emerged from his train to find the central square covered with a thick layer of snow. Paul's carriage cut lines through the snow as it carried him to the largest of the great factories that ringed the village. 8 separate 4-story structures extended for what looked like an acre in each direction. Smoke plumed from stone stacks above each one. Paul found the executive offices in the largest of the buildings. Thompson Houston Electric Company was etched in wide type above the doorway. A series of secretaries passed him back through the hallways until finally he reached a rear office. Inside, Charles Coffin leaned against his desk.
He'd been waiting for Paul's arrival all morning and gave no pretense of having been busy with other affairs.
"Mr. Cravath," said Coffin, "I had rather suspected I'd never see you again."
"I had rather hoped for the same." Coffin smiled.
"You really dislike me, don't you?"
"You betrayed me and you betrayed Westinghouse, and you did so against all of your better technical and scientific judgment. What do you think?"
"That no one likes a sore loser."
Doing business with this man made Paul furious. But Coffin's duplicity had become the very quality that Paul now required. "You've agreed to meet me," said Paul. "So I take it you've spoken with Mr. Morgan."
"I received a letter," replied Coffin. "It beseeched me to hear you out."
"I can't quite imagine Mr. Morgan doing much beseeching, but I'm glad you've acquiesced nonetheless."
"You said you had a business proposal for me, and that this proposal should stay far from the ears of Thomas Edison.
Under normal circumstances, of course, I would have told you to go to hell. But if you've involved Morgan, whatever you're doing must be quite serious. I've come to ask you a very simple question. How would you like to be the new head of EGE? Coffin tried very hard not to show how stunned he was. He looked down at his polished shoes.
"That's quite an offer," said Coffin.
Paul shrugged nonchalantly. Morgan was wearing off on him.
"And what about Thomas Edison?"
"He's outlasted his usefulness."
"To whom?"
"To Morgan, for one," said Paul, "and perhaps to the world as well." Paul paced the soft carpets as he continued.
"You are running quite a little company here, aren't you?
Thomson Houston has a profit ratio triple that of EGE and quadruple that of Westinghouse. Morgan has noticed. So have I. Edison and Westinghouse, they're scientists, but you, Mr. Coffin, have proven yourself to be a businessman. A shrewd one."
"And what would be the play of a shrewd businessman in this situation?"
"He'd know in which direction the wind was blowing, and he'd arrange his sails accordingly." Coffin smiled. It felt as if they were bonded together by their mutual antipathy.
"How would this work?" Coffin asked.
"You agree to sell Thomson Houston to EGE.
You want me to sell my company to Edison.
I want you to sell your company to Morgan, just as Morgan convinces the other EGE investors to fire Edison."
"Then Morgan owns both companies."
"Yes," said Paul. "At which point he can combine them and install you as the new president."
"Why would he want me to?"
Coffin trailed off. Paul waited silently as Coffin figured it out.
"Oh my," said Coffin. "As the head of this new conglomerate, I would have free rein to do things such as, for instance, negotiate a licensing deal between Westinghouse and EGE? A deal of which Edison would never approve?"
"I knew you were the right man for the job."
"Why me? You could get anyone to be Morgan's stooge. He'll own a majority share in the thing no matter who its president would be."
"True," answered Paul. "But you'd actually be good at the job." Paul had no need to admire the talents that Coffin possessed. He had only to harness them. "What Morgan wants above all else," continued Paul, "is returns. No more feuds, no more personal vendettas. When you're in charge, you'll make the deal with Westinghouse because you know it makes financial sense. It's good business. And you, sir, are a filthy bastard whom I do not trust so far as I can throw you. Which means I can trust you to always do what is good business." Coffin tapped his fingertips against the desk. He was being offered the position of president of the largest lighting company
in America. When all these deals were concluded, Coffin would be among the most powerful industrial executives in the world. His fingers danced gentle rhythms against the wood. "And then what of Edison?" Coffin asked at last. "What becomes of